Any questions from discussion group anyone would like to bring up before we move on?
No?
Okay. Okay, then let's go back into the text here. So we are looking at the three trainings, which are the practices that we need to engage in to strive for the goal of liberation from samsara, for the goal of nirvana. And so we saw that the three trainings here are ethics, concentration, and wisdom. And within the concentration practice here, then normally within this level of practice that is practiced these days in the Theravada traditions, the practice is focused mainly on developing these four dhyanas. Whereas, as we're going to see later in the Mahayana section of the practice here, when we talk about the concentration practice, it's referring to developing the shamatha level of concentration. And then within the wisdom practice here, then the vipassana practice that is often presented here is in terms of these three marks of existence, that we're trying to come to realize impermanence, dukkha, and no self. And so here we saw that this wisdom of no self, we can talk about self being an overinflated false sense of me at these sort of two levels here, and that the one that we now instinctively have, this false sense, is this idea of this self-sufficient, substantially existent self, and that we can come to realize there is no such self, and thereby overcome the mental afflictions and suffering and achieve liberation, achieve nirvana. But as we're going to see also later in the Mahayana, when we look at the Vipassana practice, then there, it's according to that philosophical system, then this is actually not going to be enough to achieve nirvana. That it's a good realization and it will help a lot, but actually we have to come to realize this wisdom of emptiness. There's no independent me, no independent objective world, that we have to have this wisdom to achieve nirvana and then also to go on to enlightenment. And then if we just finish off the three trainings here in your text, there's the outline halfway down page 19, the objects that they eliminate. It says here, in relation to the objects they eliminate, the afflictions, the trainings are threefold, according to whether they eliminate afflictions by, one, weakening them. So it's our ethical practice, our practice of ethics, including the purification through the four opponent powers, that weakens our mental afflictions and weakens the habits. Then the second one is suppressing their manifest forms. So this is related to the concentration practice, that when we really develop concentration practice, a shamatha practice, our mind becomes very stable, calm and clear. Then because of that state of mind, then it's hard for the mental afflictions to manifest. And so then we can really keep the lid on the mental afflictions. And so that's what it means here by suppressing their manifest forms, that through the power of our concentration, then it's hard for the mental afflictions to arise. But we're not, of course, yet eliminating them. We're just keeping the lid on them because of the calm, clear mind of concentration. And then the third one here, it says, by eradicating their seeds. So, of course, this is referring to the wisdom practice, that by coming to realize the wisdom of emptiness, then that will eliminate the mental afflictions and their seeds
from the root. So this is the how the three trainings work to weaken, suppress and eliminate the mental afflictions. Then, just briefly, the next outline, the determination of the order of the three trainings. It says here, ethical discipline is the root because the other two grow out of it. So the basis, of course, is ethics. And then it says, concentration, the second of the three trainings, depends on ethical discipline and takes pleasure in putting the mind in meditative equipoise. Wisdom, the third of the three trainings, depends on meditative equipoise and acquires the view of noble beings in order to see reality exactly. So each one of those trainings then builds on the previous. So that's why they're presented in that order of ethics, concentration, wisdom. So that's all I wanted to mention then about the three trainings in terms of the practices to achieve the goal of nirvana, the person of medium capacity. So what we're going to do now is go on to look at the person of great capacity. But before I do that, any last questions? Yeah.
Can you just quickly go back to suppressing their manifest forms?
Yeah. We can sort of know this from our own experience. Like when we are very peaceful and calm, it's harder for us to get irritated or agitated, isn't it? So likewise, if we are already sort of distracted and so forth, then it's much easier for mental afflictions to arise. So if we engage in this concentration practice, then our mind will be more naturally in this very quiet, still, peaceful state, which means that even if we receive some stimulus, it's much harder for that stimulus to cause a mental affliction to arise. So that's what it means by suppressing the manifest forms. Okay, so let's now move on to the person of great capacity. So we're sort of down towards the bottom of page 19. So the person of medium capacity, remember, is striving to make the life meaningful by striving for the goal of liberation, personal liberation from samsara, the goal of nirvana. But of course, at that level of practice, we can understand that, well, we're not the only ones stuck in samsara, so is everyone else. So then we can build on our motivation in that not only wishing to liberate ourselves from suffering, but also then wishing to help liberate everyone else from samsara. So this is someone of great capacity is developing this aspiration. So let's see what's involved there. So if we read a little bit what's under that main heading there, training in the mind in the stages of the path for persons of great capacity, it says, persons of great capacity, under the influence of great compassion, make Buddhahood their goal in order to extinguish all the sufferings of all living beings. They then train in the six perfections, the two stages and the like. The Mahayana is the origin of all good, of self and others. So here then, we see this Mahayana vehicle. So I just want to clarify a few things here to hopefully avoid some confusion. In that, you know, we had this chart here, this three vehicles chart. So we have in there Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana. So then often when we have in the text, it talks about the three vehicles, then it can refer to these three. So, of course, within the Theravada vehicle, the goal is personal liberation, is nirvana. In the Mahayana, the goal is enlightenment, so that we can help liberate everyone from samsara. And then at the higher level of Vajrayana, we also have the same goal,
but then we're trying to use a more subtle level of mind to get to that goal more quickly. So often then we see that these are the presentation of the three vehicles. But sometimes also in the text it says, it talks about the three vehicles, but it lists them differently. And we've already seen this a little bit earlier in the text. There was a point mentioned about the Shravaka and the Pratyeka Buddha. So the Shravaka is translated often as the hearer. So it's someone who really hears a lot of instructions, and that's their approach to practice. Whereas the Pratyeka Buddha is often translated as solitary realizer. This style of practitioner would initially get some instructions, but then would really go off on their own and in solitude then achieve the goal. But both of these types of practitioner are striving for the goal of nirvana. Which, of course, is the goal of the Theravada vehicle. So both of those are striving for this goal of nirvana. And then in this list, then the third one is either sometimes called the Mahayana or sometimes the Bodhisattva vehicle. So then, of course, the goal of the Bodhisattva vehicle, or sometimes it's even called Mahayana vehicle, is enlightenment. And, of course, the Mahayana, both Mahayana and Vajrayana are striving for that goal of enlightenment. So what we can see here is that it's just a different way of breaking up the different types of practitioner. So we just need to bear that in mind, that sometimes in the text it says the three vehicles. And so we need to see, are they referring this way or this way? But both are equally valid. It's just a different way of dividing up things. Also, sometimes here, you'll see a presentation not of three vehicles, but two vehicles. Theravada Mahayana, or sometimes here instead of Theravada they'll use the word Hinayana. And then within these two vehicles, then often when they talk about the Mahayana vehicle, then they'll say there are actually two levels of practice in the Mahayana, which are often listed as something like Sutra and Tantra. And so, of course, here when we talk about Tantra, this is another name for Vajrayana. So, therefore, sometimes instead of having these three vehicles, then they'll only list two, and they'll say within the Mahayana there are these two levels of practice. But there's no difference between doing that and making that a separate vehicle. It's just a way of categorizing, that's all. And also here, with these names of Sutra and Tantra, at this level of practice here, as we're going to see, the main practices are the six perfections. So sometimes this level, or the Mahayana vehicle here, is simply called the perfection vehicle. And also, I think, in the text here, sometimes this Tantra or Vajrayana vehicle is called the mantra vehicle. So we have different ways of categorizing and different names, but it all amounts to the same thing. While we're on that point, mantra, if we look at the syllables of that, literally means to protect the mind. To protect the mind. And so why Vajrayana or Tantra is called mantra vehicle is that within Tantra or Vajrayana, we are protecting the mind from ordinary appearances. We are developing what's called divine pride, divine appearances. So we are trying to, within the Tantra or Vajrayana level of practice, which we're going to look right at the end of this Lam Rim, then the perspective of the path is completely different. Both within Theravada and Mahayana, there is this perspective of, they're often called causal vehicles. Because both Theravada and Mahayana are looking at the spiritual path from the perspective of the cause. Here we are now. There's the goal of nirvana and enlightenment. These are the practices that I need to do, engage in, to create the causes to achieve that result. So we're looking forward on the spiritual path. Whereas Vajrayana or Tantra vehicle is sometimes called the resultant vehicle. And the reason it's called that is that we use this perspective in practice. In that Tantra or Vajrayana vehicle, we do the practice from the perspective of the enlightened state. And this is an approach that sometimes also we see is being used in sport. You know, people imagining having gone through their whole routine and achieved the result, and then they do their activity. And it's a very powerful way to actually achieve that result. So similarly here in Vajrayana Tantra, then often we do all the practices from the perspective of being in the fully enlightened state. So we have this what's called pure appearance. And so, therefore, that's why it's called mantra vehicle, is because this practice protects the mind from these ordinary appearances. But anyway, we're going to talk a little bit more about this right at the end of the Lam Rim. So I just briefly mentioned that. So, therefore, we have different ways of dividing up, but they all amount to the same thing. Any questions about any of those categorizations?
You said causal applied to both Theravada and Mahayana?
Yeah, both causal, yes.
And is it resultant?
Resultant is Vajrayana.
Resultant vehicle.
Yeah, resultant vehicle. Sometimes also you see another way of dividing is, you know, we have this Sutra Tantra, but actually also within the Theravada they're following the sutras. So sometimes you just have a division into Sutrayana and Tantrayana. Mm-hmm. And so Sutrayana then covers both of these. So this is Sutrayana, Tantrayana. So there are many ways of, you know, splitting, dividing, and categorizing. And different texts use different ones for different reasons. That's all. But they're all more or less saying the same thing. It's just a different way of naming and grouping, that's all. Okay, so here then, like the first two levels, the small and medium level, the first thing we need to do, of course, is develop the aspiration for the goal. And so here, of course, the goal is enlightenment. So the first part here is to develop the aspiration for that, which, of course, is called bodhicitta. And in this text, it's translated as the spirit of enlightenment. Bodhi is enlightenment and citta is mind. So literally it's the mind of enlightenment. And again here in this text is translated as spirit of enlightenment.
So if we look at the first outline there showing that developing the spirit of enlightenment is the only entrance to the Mahayana, it says the only entrance is the spirit of enlightenment. So the door of entry into the Mahayana is when we develop this bodhicitta. So we can talk about the door of entry into different levels of practice. And the first door of entry that we came across much earlier in the text was the door of entry into the Buddhist teachings in general, which of course are called the Dharma. And so remember that the door of entry into the Dharma, of course, is when we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So remember, when we take refuge, that's when we can be considered to be a Buddhist. We have placed our trust and faith in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, particularly the Dharma. So this is what marks the entrance into the Dharma in general, or the Buddhist teachings in general. But then within that, of course, the next level or the next entry point is to enter into the Theravada path to Nirvana, which we've just covered. And so remember, there we saw that the door of entry or the aspiration we need to develop to enter into that path was renunciation. And now, of course, at the next level of practice, we're looking here at the Mahayana. The door of entry here is when we develop the aspiration for enlightenment. So, of course, bodhicitta. And then, of course, the next level of practice is Vajrayana, or Tantra. And what is the door of entry into the Vajrayana or Tantra level of practice? Is what's called empowerment or initiation. Where the tantric master would introduce us into the tantric practice through this empowerment. So these are the doors of entry to the various levels that we are following here in the spiritual path, in the Buddhist spiritual path. Any question about this? Yeah.
If a teacher was going to do the empowerment, I suppose they would try and verify the other ones, you know?
Yeah. I mean, generally, I mean, historically, how it would work, of course, is that you would be having your personal teacher. They would be guiding you in these foundation practices. And then at some point, once you've established a good foundation, then they would see that you're ready for this level and then say, okay, I think it's time for you to enter into this. Here's the empowerment.
Right.
That's how it traditionally would work. So historically, you would never hear anything about Tantra or Vajrayana except in that case. I mean, there was no texts around or anything.
You wouldn't know it existed until...
You would have heard about it because right. You would have seen other people and you would have heard something about it, but that's all. You wouldn't know anything about it. Nothing. But, again, I'm going to talk more about that right at the end of our... because there's a few important things to mention here to avoid difficulties. Okay. So then if we look here in that same paragraph, it says here, once you have generated the spirit in your mind, you are recognized as a Mahayana practitioner, even though you may have not generated any other good quality. This point is taught in many Mahayana scriptures, also proved by reason. Hence, if you have only an intellectual understanding of this spirit, then you likewise only have an intellectual understanding of what it means to be a Mahayana practitioner. If the spirit is completely perfect, then the Mahayana practitioner is genuine, so strive for this. So what does that mean? To answer that, if you want to get your Mahayana path chart, the answer is on there. And again, here we've had the chopping off of things on the left, so you have to fill in. You have to fill in a few things. So halfway down here it says tones. That's actually milestones. Milestones. And the first is inferential, the first line. The second line is uncontrived. The third line is will. The fourth line is union. The fifth is roots. The sixth is no. The seventh is initial. The eighth is abandoned. The ninth is nirvana, and tenth, enlightenment. And then beside each one of those, they have a number. So they're numbered from 1 up to 10 okay. as well. Because those numbers correspond to the numbers along the bottom here. And, of course, number 1 is missing, so you can stick in a number 1 just a little bit to the left of number 2. That's all. So what I wanted to point out here is number 2, where it says uncontrived renunciation and bodhicitta. And that is marking the entry point into the Mahayana path. So that's what's being mentioned here in the text, is that now, of course, we can sit down and think about how to develop this bodhicitta, which we're going to look at very shortly. And then we may actually, for a moment, have this aspiration. May I achieve enlightenment for the welfare of others? But then 2 minutes later, we forget that and we run off and do our own thing, you know. So that's what's called contrived bodhicitta, meaning that we have to put effort, reflect on various things to generate it. And it lasts for a short time and then it sort of dissipates. But if we continue to cultivate this aspiration of bodhicitta and deepen it, at some point then it really becomes stable. And it's something that spontaneously and naturally comes up through the day. That is called uncontrived bodhicitta. That marks the entry point to the Mahayana path. That is what's being referred to here in the Lam Rim about the spirit is perfectly perfect, completely perfect, in that it is stable and it is something that spontaneously and continuously arises in us. So let's now have a look at how we go about cultivating that. So then we can go over onto page 20. And a little bit down, there's an outline B that says the development of the spirit through the four causes. And so here it lists first perfect lineage. So this lineage is, I think I briefly mentioned earlier, when we talk about lineage, we're talking about different styles of practice. So one lineage is called the Shravaka lineage. Another lineage is the Pratika Buddha lineage. And another one is the Bodhisattva or Mahayana lineage. So that's what it means here, perfect lineage. It means that we have an aspiration to go in that direction. That's the perfect lineage, that we are wanting to follow this way of practice. And then, no, that's from our side. Then it says being sustained by a teacher. So again, very helpful, to have a teacher, and of course here the teacher, it would be a teacher of the Mahayana. And then the third point is compassion towards living beings. And as we're going to see a little bit further down in the text, it says that compassion is the root of the Mahayana path. And in fact, when we talk about this being in the Mahayana lineage, then it often talks about how we can activate our Mahayana lineage. And it said that when we really have this great compassion for sentient beings, we have activated the Mahayana lineage, because this is really what is going to then be the root or the basis for us to really move into the Mahayana path. And then lastly, number four is not being disheartened by the difficulties of cyclic existence. So what we're going to see quite a lot in the Six Perfections practices is this idea of perseverance and to be able to deal with hardships and not be overwhelmed by them. So that is also a key factor here in following the Mahayana path. So then if we look down a little bit further, the stages of training in the spirit of enlightenment, there are two main outlines. The first one says here, training based on the seven cause and effect personal instructions in the lineage descended from the great elder Atisha. And then if we go down towards the bottom of page 21, we see the training based on the teachings of the conqueror's child, Shantideva. So what this is showing us here is that there were two main methods taught on how to develop or cultivate bodhicitta. And we're going to look at both of those. And the first one we're looking at here is the seven cause and effect method. And this was the main method that was generally taught in ancient India and ancient Tibet. And the second method, the one that says is coming from Shantideva, which is called exchanging self with others, was often historically considered too profound, too difficult for the average person to implement. But as we're going to see, actually, I think in our modern day world, often the second technique is more effective. One of the reasons being is in the first technique, the seven cause and effect, which we're going to look at shortly, is that inbuilt into the technique are two things which sometimes can create problems. The first is that this technique assumes a belief in rebirth. For the logic in the technique to really work well, we have to assume rebirth. So that's already sometimes a little bit of a stumbling block for some of us. And the second is that, as we're going to see, that the very first point here is to recognize all beings as your mother. So, of course, to be able to do that requires really a belief in rebirth, because we had a mother in this life, and then in the past life we had a mother, and we keep going back. And through that sort of logic, we can come to understand that everyone's been our mother at some time. But also the other problem here often is that, I mean, the idea being in the first step of seeing everyone as our mother is that historically, at least, the mother is the one who's often benefited us most, been most kind to us in our life. And so by seeing everyone as our mother, the goal of the first step is to develop a sense of closeness to everyone. But unfortunately, in our modern-day society, many people have issues with their mother. So if we see everyone as our mother, we start hating everyone. So that's not the point. So then sometimes the text says that if you have difficulties with your mother, then substitute father or brother, sister, teacher, uncle, aunt, whatever. Because if we have a belief in rebirth, then we have every sort of relationship with everyone. So just pick then someone or some person in our life that we have received a lot of kindness from, and then use that approach. So that's one way of overcoming that difficulty. And as we're going to see as well, just a bit, I said down further there, it talks about that the root of the Mahayana path is compassion. And also one of these seven steps is to develop loving kindness. And then also, if we go over the page on 21, right at the top, it talks about establishing the basis for developing this attitude. And it talks, the first outline there is achieving impartiality towards living beings. So what it's saying is that as a basis to begin this seven cause and effect method, we have to be impartial towards all living beings. Or this sometimes is translated as equanimity, to have equanimity. So we'll come to that later, actually. So therefore, what I'd like to do before we look at the seven cause and effect method is look at how we can develop an effective basis to even begin this cultivation of bodhicitta. And that effective basis is what's called the four immeasurables. The four immeasurables are four qualities that we are trying to cultivate for immeasurable sentient beings, meaning all sentient beings, all living beings. And so by cultivating these four, then we have a very good basis to enter into both of these approaches to bodhicitta, the seven cause and effect and exchanging self with others. So let's have a look at these four immeasurables, what they are and how to cultivate them. So the first is loving kindness, which again in Sanskrit is Maitri, in Pali is Metta. And loving kindness in general, of course, is the wish for ourselves and others to be happy or to have happiness and its causes. Immeasurable loving kindness is the wish for all living beings or all sentient beings to have happiness and its causes. And similar to that, we have compassion. Which in Sanskrit and Pali is karuna. So compassion in general, of course, is the wish for ourselves and others to be free of suffering and its causes. So immeasurable compassion is the wish for all living beings or all sentient beings to be free of suffering and its causes. So with both of these, then it's best to develop them in stages. And generally, the stages that are recommended is that we first develop loving kindness and compassion or cultivate that towards people close to us, our so-called friends. And once we're comfortable with that, then we extend it out to people we don't know very well, the so-called stranger. And then we can slowly extend it out to people who we find a little bit difficult, so the so-called enemy. And then eventually we can extend it to all sentient beings. And so this is very much emphasized in this Lam Rim text. And for that purpose, I'd like to read a little bit from the Lam Rim Chenmo itself about what it says on this point here. So this is volume 2 we're in now, page 43. It talks about first the stages of cultivating. Here it uses the word love, but you know, I, like I said, I prefer the word loving kindness, but we're talking about the same thing, of course. It says here, first cultivate love toward friends, then cultivate love for persons toward whom you have neutral feelings. Next, cultivate love toward your enemies, then cultivate it gradually towards all beings. And we have a similar answer when we talk about the compassion section here over the page. It says, cultivating compassion. The steps are first to cultivate it towards friends, then towards those beings with whom you have neutral feelings, and next towards enemies. When you have equal compassion for your enemies and friends, cultivate it gradually toward all living beings in the, it says, the 10 directions. So often when we see the 10 directions, of course we have the 4 cardinal directions, north, south, east, west, and then the 4 intermediates, so that's 8, and then the other 2 is the up and the down. So that's what it means by basically in all directions.
Is down specifically like beings in hell?
No. It's just just directions, the physical directions.
South
that's
America,
all. Yeah. Yeah. Even for those south of the border. Okay. Yeah. Work on it, yes. First Southern California, then keep going down. Okay. Going on in that section, it says, Kamala Sheela, who was a great Indian master from the 8th century, he was he was around the time of Padmasambhava Shantarakshita. He says, Kamala Sheela, following the discourses on knowledge, set out this way of gradually cultivating impartiality, which is this equanimity, love and compassion, while distinguishing specific objects of meditation. It is an extremely important point. If you train in these attitudes of impartiality, love and compassion, without distinguishing and taking up specific objects of meditation, but only using a general object from the outset, you will just seem to generate these attitudes. Then when you try to apply them to specific individuals, you will not be able to actually generate these attitudes toward anyone. But once you have a transformative experience toward an individual in your meditation practice, as explained previously, you may then gradually increase the number of individuals you visualize within your meditation. Finally, take all beings in general as your object of meditation. When you sustain this practice in meditation, you will generate these attitudes correctly, whether you are dealing with individuals or a group. So I think this is a quite important point, because often what we find is that as part of this cultivation of the four immeasurables, there's often this four-line verse, the four immeasurables, within practices. And often it comes at the beginning, and the first line says, may all sentient beings have happiness in its causes. May all sentient beings be free of suffering in its causes, and so on. And, of course, it's very easy for that to roll off the tongue. And it feels like, yes, I have love and compassion for everyone. But then when we think about a certain person at work, we go, except that person. That person, no, because they're not very nice. So this is what it means here, is that in this cultivation, if we just simply have this, may everyone be happy and be free of suffering, it's easy to fool ourselves that we have love and compassion for everyone. But then, of course, we step outside and then the first person that irritates us, we get angry at them. So then where did our love and compassion go? Sort of out the window. I think that was what's being mentioned here. Yeah.
What does he mean by a transformative experience in meditation?
Well, again, it really means in a heartfelt way that we really heartfelt wish them to be happy, wish them to be free of suffering.
Are we assuming that we've already applied these qualities to ourselves first?
That's my very next point. So what we saw here in the text, there's not any much mention about ourselves.
And I think the reason is, in this era, people usually felt pretty good about themselves. But, of course, and in our modern society, that's often not the case. So, of course, if, as you correctly said, if we don't have loving kindness and compassion for ourselves, we're not going to be able to extend it out to others. So often then, in our modern society, we need to add an extra step. If we're not feeling good about ourselves, if we suffer from low self-esteem or self-hatred, then this is where we need to start. We need to start with this, with ourselves. We need to develop loving kindness and compassion for ourselves first. But not mentioned in the text here, because I think in those days, that wasn't a problem. You know, in fact, I remember in one of the very early Mind and Life conferences, and the Mind and Life is where His Holiness and Buddhist scholars come together with scientific community to discuss various topics in terms of brain, neuroscience, psychology, all sorts of topics. One of the very early ones, many years ago, there was a discussion, and I can't remember the context, but it came up something about suffering from low self-esteem. And then when that was explained, His Holiness goes, "Oh, no, I don't. And then the translator turned to the audience, who were mostly Western scientists, and said, "How many of you suffer low self-esteem?" And like many of them put their hand up, and His Holiness was quite shocked, you know. What? And also, many years ago, when Tibetan lamas were first coming to the West, and then the Westerners were going and asking personal questions, of course, a lot of the questions were this sort of guilt, low self-esteem questions, you know, what, how to deal with that. And the translator in the early days had so much trouble trying to explain what the question was. Because one, there is no word for guilt in the Tibetan language. It doesn't. There is not. There isn't. And then what this low self-esteem is, you know, like it's like foreign thing. So this translator had so much trouble just to tell the Lama what the question was. So, you know, so I think we, of course, therefore need to work on this ourselves if we don't have loving kindness and compassion for ourselves. That's where we need to start. Okay. Yes, in fact, that's very much, actually, that's a little bit highlighted. I found a section in the text a little bit related to that. It said on page 44 at the bottom, it says, "Moreover, if you have developed an awareness of your own general and specific suffering by training in the path of the person of medium capacity, you will assess your own situation and cultivate compassion towards others. By following this method, you will easily generate compassion. Considering your own suffering creates the determination to be free. Thinking about others' suffering creates compassion. However, if you do not first consider your own suffering, you will not reach the key point of the practice." So I don't think that's talking so much about low self-esteem. It's just saying that if we can develop this compassion for ourselves, seeing our own suffering, then we can connect with others in a better way. But certainly if we are someone who really does suffer from the low self-esteem and so forth, this is really where we need to start with loving kindness and compassion. Then the third of the four immeasurables is empathetic joy, or mudita in Sanskrit. Empathetic joy is a rejoicing in our own and others' virtue and good fortune. So here then, immeasurable empathetic joy is this wish for all sentient beings never to be separated from their happiness. And this is very important for a couple of reasons. One, of course,
is that normally when we see others who get something, instead of rejoicing in that, we often become jealous. You know, I want that. So this empathetic joy is a very good antidote to jealousy. But also, as I think already mentioned earlier, we have so much an emphasis on the negative. We're always focusing on the negative, and also often with cognitive fusion. And I think that's why often we have a lot of low self-esteem and so forth. So what we need to do, of course, is one, first is stop cognitive fusion with the negative. Secondly, we need to have a balanced view of ourselves and others, meaning also to focus on the positive aspects. And so this empathetic joy is very helpful for that, a rejoicing in our own and others' good behaviour and good fortune. So this empathetic joy, I think, is something very important, and that is very much related to one of the six perfections practices that we're going to look at tomorrow, the fourth one of joyous effort, that also in our practice we need to have a joyful mind and not see practice as some sort of hardship. So these are very important points, and I'm going to talk more about that joyous effort tomorrow in the context of the six perfections. But then we've got one more of the four immeasurables to cover. And that is equanimity or upeksha. In this translation, they're translating upeksha not as equanimity but as impartiality. So if we have a look, it talks about this quality in page 21 at the top when it talks about the basis for this seven cause and effect method. So it says here, from the outset, establish an even-minded attitude, eliminating the bias which comes from attachment to some living beings and hostility to others. Otherwise, any love or compassion you feel will be biased. There are three kinds of impartiality. So this word impartiality or equanimity comes up in three different contexts. The first one, it says equanimity with respect to application. We're going to be looking at that in the context of shamatha practice. What that means is one of the faults in shamatha practice is if we are focusing, and often when we're focusing on an object, we have to keep adjusting the focus because we're starting to get distracted or dull, so we have to keep adjusting the focus to keep it on track. But of course, if our focus is clear and focused and we keep adjusting, then that's a fault. How to overcome that is what this means. Equanimity with respect to application, it means leave the mind as it is. So that's what it's talking about. So, of course, the saying there is, if it's not broken, don't fix it. So this is what it's talking about here. The first type of equanimity is this equanimity within shamatha practice of balance. Of the mind is already balanced, so leave it like that. Don't do anything. The second one is the feeling of impartiality. Here, this is what we looked at earlier as the neutral feeling. You know, there's pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. So that's this. And then the third one is immeasurable impartiality, or that's what we're talking about here, immeasurable equanimity. In this section, impartiality or equanimity refers to the last one, so that's what we're looking at. Immeasurable impartiality or equanimity is said to have two types: wishing that living beings were free from such afflictions as attachment and hostility, and two, being even-minded yourself after you have become free from attachment and hostility toward living beings. In this section, impartiality refers to the latter. So here, as a basis for the seven cause and effect, then we ourselves, of course, need to have the mind of equanimity, not having attachment to some, aversion to others. Of course, in immeasurable equanimity is the wish for all living beings to have the equanimity free from attachment to some, aversion to others. The long definition of this, of course, is based on the idea, as mentioned here in the text, that now we tend to be very biased. And often in our experiences, we have quite a narrow perspective. And we often go into experiences or situations from the perspective of, how does this situation affect me? And if we have this perspective, then when we interact with others, we tend to categorize people into three groups, depending on how they're affecting us. And so those people who seem to be supporting our happiness, friend. Those people around us who don't seem to be affecting us in any way, stranger. And those people around us who seem to be interfering with our happiness and maybe even seem to be causing us suffering, the so-called enemy. And then, of course, with that attitude, with this categorization, we have a very biased attitude towards everyone. Because to the friend, we may have love and compassion, but it'll be polluted by attachment. You know. To the stranger, I don't care what happens to them, they're not affecting me. So we tend to be very apathetic or indifferent because they're not affecting us, so I don't care what happens to them. And to the other group, the so-called enemy, love and compassion? No way. Because you are causing me suffering. In fact, I hope you suffer. So we have aversion, often hostility, anger, hatred to the enemy, apathy, indifference to stranger, and attachment to the friends. So this is what we're trying to overcome. And so this is what equanimity is the long definition of this equanimity is, may all sentient beings have an equanimity which is free of attachment to friends, free of apathy to strangers, free of hostility, anger, hatred to difficult people or the enemy. But often it sort of shortens it and simply, may all sentient beings be free of attachment to some and aversion to others. Something like that is often the short version of this. Any questions on the four immeasurables? One more thing I'd like to add before we then now look at the seven cause and effect method is each one of those has what's called the near enemy. The near enemy is something that looks like this but actually is opposite. The far enemy is easy because we know that's opposite and we try to avoid it. But the near enemy is something that creeps in and it seems like it's this thing, but it's not, but actually it's the opposite. So each one of these has a near enemy that we have to pay attention to. But fortunately, one of the other four immeasurables is the antidote to that. So they can help each other. So we can look at that now. So, of course, the near enemy of loving kindness is attachment. And as we've just seen, the antidote to attachment is to cultivate equanimity. So if we find or feel that our loving kindness is slipping into attachment, then it's a good time to work on equanimity. The near enemy of equanimity is indifference. Because remember, equanimity is this equal attitude towards others. But of course, it's an equal sense of closeness. Indifference is, of course, equal attitude, but equally indifferent. So if we find that we are simply becoming indifferent to others, that's a good time to reflect on compassion, the fact that we're suffering. And the near enemy of compassion is often that we try to develop this compassion, but then we slide into this sort of desperation or depression. Everything's overwhelming. So if we find our compassionate motivation is sliding into this sort of desperation or depression, then that's a good time to reflect on empathetic joy. And the near enemy, remember, empathetic joy is rejoicing in others' virtues. But this rejoicing can slip into just frivolous rejoicing, rejoicing in not meaningful things. So if we find that our rejoicing is we're simply rejoicing in meaningless things, frivolity, then that's a good time to reflect on loving kindness. Wishing others this genuine happiness. So this is how each of them have their own sort of near enemy that's easy to slide into, and the way which we can overcome that. Yeah.
I just have to say again that 10 minutes beat a year and a half of therapy.
They've been doing that
twice. I mean, there's really only one, and it was just like, okay, there you go. Been for that for a year and a half.
Okay, good. I'm happy. Yeah.
So the near enemies, and I, like, for compassion, pity jumps out.
I mean, it's the same, it's sort of the same flavor. It's this sort of like this hopelessness, you know. It's this hopelessness, you know, it's all just hopeless. And I think here, reflecting on the empathetic joy can be a good balance, because here what often happens is we're so much focused on the negative, and often with cognitive fusion, so everything seems like hopeless.
Yeah, I've understood compassion to be, I'm not sure how to say it, but an active sort of thing. You don't just see and feel with the suffering of other people, but you actively determine to do what.
Exactly. I mean, authentic compassion is there's hope, there's something we can do. Exactly. So if this is pure, then of course we won't slide into this. Compassion is not just seeing the suffering. But compassion is seeing the suffering and understanding we can do something.
It's a determination to help.
Yeah, I mean, of course. What is compassion? The wish for them to be free of suffering. And so in immeasurable compassion, actually now's a good time to bring it in. Immeasurable compassion is the wish for all living beings to be free of suffering. In the seven cause and effect, it's what's called great compassion. So actually if we look in our hand, in the text here, in the cultivation of compassion, halfway down 21,
It says, how nice it would be if living beings were free from suffering. So this is what we're talking about here. But then it goes on to say, may they be free of suffering. I will cause them to be free of suffering. So this is great compassion. So this is just having the wish for them to be free of suffering. But here we're saying that actually I am going to help them to be free of suffering. So that's, as you said, the next step. So compassion is not just, oh, poor them. Because then it can slide into this sort of depression, hopelessness. Compassion is seeing the suffering of others and understanding there's something that can be done. And then we can take that next step of making a determination that we are going to do something. But the first step, of course, is just have, as it says here, to have the wish for them to be free of suffering. And then we can build on that by saying that I am going to help them to be free of suffering. That's the next step, the more proactive step. Okay. Let's have a look at the seven cause and effect now. So they're listed at the top of that section, and they're listed sort of in reverse order. So again, if we go down to the section, so at the top of page 21, it says that first we need to establish the basis for developing this. And so remember, the basis is that we need to start with a non-biased mind. So we need to develop this equanimity, this equal attitude towards others. And then on that basis, the first three steps is here it says having affection for all beings. So it's developing this sense of closeness and affection. And we do that with the first three steps of the seven cause and effect. So the first step, of course, here is to see everyone as our mother. So again, this, to really be able to do this effectively, implies a belief in rebirth. And again, if we have difficulties with our mother, then we can substitute father, brother, sister, some other person. Because if we've had that relationship with everyone anyway. Actually, it'll come in the next step. So then the idea being here is by seeing everyone as our mother to develop a sense of closeness to everyone. The second one is to remember their kindness. And of course, at least historically, generally, the mother is the one who was most kind to us, you know, kept us in the womb for 9 months, gave birth to us, looked after us as a baby, fed and clothed us, and so on and so on. So to reflect on all of these points. But again, what we can do here is, in particular, if we're not really having so much a belief in rebirth, then there is a very closely related meditation to this of just the kindness of others. And so we can sort of try and bring that in here maybe, is that, you know, again, we tend to categorize people in terms of how they affect us. And so we say, well, yes, our friends are very kind to us. These people, well, they don't do anything. They're not sort of particularly kind. And these people, definitely not kind because they're trying to harm me. But actually, if we look at a situation here in the world, we could say everyone on the planet is kind to us. everybody, because we're not living in isolation. So everything we have is through the kindness of others. But then often people say, yeah, yeah, but they didn't deliberately want to be kind to us. The bottom line, of course, is that we have benefited. You know, when we're talking about the kindness of others, we're really talking about us receiving benefit. Because actually, when we come to develop, when we come to develop patience, who is more kind to us? The people who always say nice things or the people who test us? Who is more kind to us in terms of developing patience? The people who test us. So actually they're more kind to us, aren't they? So this is how we should relate to the kindness of others. If we think the kindness of others, who are the ones who have said nice things and given me stuff? In fact, sometimes that behaviour is not good for us, is it? So actually they're not being kind to us often, these people who give us lots of stuff, because then we can develop a habit of wanting more and more stuff. So they're not really being kind to us. So kindness is in terms of benefit. And we can learn from everybody. We can benefit from everyone. So in that way, we can really appreciate the fact that everyone is kind to us. And as the story of Lama Atisha I mentioned before, often the people who are most challenging in our life are the most kind people in our life, really. Because it, as I mentioned before, often if we go through life floating along, everything's fine, we never really develop as a person. It's only when we're faced with a difficult situation that challenges us do we often grow and develop as a person. So often it's these very harsh people in our life that actually benefit us most, are most kind to us in terms of our own development. So we can look at that in this way. And it, this is one of the strengths of this Lojong system of practice that also Lama Atisha brought into Tibet. In Lojong, there is a section in the text that talks about bringing adverse conditions into the path. And there, you know, we talk about who is our friend and who is our enemy. So often we feel that the self-cherishing mind is our friend, bringing me happiness. And the enemy is those people out there who are trying to harm us. But in the text it says we've got it completely wrong. We've got it backwards. That our real enemy is our self-cherishing mind, and the real friends are those people out there, particularly the ones who are trying to test us. They're our real friends, because they help us to grow as a person, and they can also help us to see where we are in the path. Because if we're always surrounded by very nice people, we could have this illusion, oh yes, I don't get angry anymore. You know, I'm very patient. I'm very kind and compassionate, you know. And then someone tests us and we go, oh, hang on. Oh, yeah, maybe I'm not so patient. So they really can test us and see where we are and help us to not delude ourselves thinking we're better than we really are. Okay, so that's the second step, remembering their kindness. And the third one is cultivating the wish to repay their kindness. One point I wanted to mention. So, of course, these difficult people are kind to us in terms of challenging us and so forth. But, of course, that does not mean we should condone their behaviour. That's not what it means. But, of course, we can learn from that and be compassionate and patient and help them to overcome that negative behaviour. So these are the first three points that I mentioned here. And so by reflecting on these, we can develop really some affection for all mother sentient beings. And then the next three attitudes here is then, based on that, it says developing the attitude of being intent on others' welfare. And so here we talk about love, compassion, and this wholehearted resolve.
Mm-hmm.
So based on seeing these first three steps, we'll want to repay the kindness of all mother sentient beings. So great love here, or great loving kindness, is again not simply the wish for them to have happiness and its causes. As we see in the text here, the cultivation of love says the subjective aspect is thinking how nice it would be if sentient beings be happy. May they be happy, and I will cause them to be happy. So we are very proactive here, is that we are going to do whatever we can to establish mother sentient beings in happiness. Likewise, with the great compassion here, is not simply having a wish for all of them to be free of suffering, but we are going to put effort in establishing them to be free of suffering. And then, based on these two attitudes, we go to the sixth step, which is called here wholehearted resolve, or sometimes translated as altruistic intention. Which is to have the attitude of taking the responsibility. It says here, the thought that assumes responsibility shows you must develop compassion and love for which the power to induce the resolve. I will provide happiness and benefit to all living beings. So this sixth step is then taking on personal responsibility to help liberate all sentient beings from suffering and place them in happiness. But of course, if we've developed this resolve that I myself alone will do that, then we look at our current situation and we can understand, well, actually I can't really do a lot to help others now. My capacity is quite limited. How can I really be most effective in helping others is if I eliminate all my mental afflictions, if I fully develop all my positive qualities, if I achieve full awakening, then I can really benefit others. So that is the seventh step, is that to develop that aspiration, which is, of course, bodhicitta. Which is the result of those steps. And so here it says, in the next line, it says, once you have been inspired by the aforementioned process and have seen that you need enlightenment for the sake of others' welfare, you develop a wish to attain it. So this is bodhicitta. Is, again, bodhi is enlightenment, citta is mind. So it's literally the mind of enlightenment, the mind that aspires to enlightenment for the benefit of others. And that's what's mentioned here, is how is it defined? It says, the development of the spirit of enlightenment is the desire for perfect enlightenment for others' welfare. So two things to mention here is, first, the word desire. Sometimes in Buddhism, of course, it's said that desire is the root of all evil, you need to get rid of it. But then it says here that we need to develop this desire for enlightenment. So how can we develop this and get rid of it at the same time? So the question here, of course, is that when we say that desire is the source of suffering, we're talking about attachment, craving. Here, the same word desire is talking about aspiration. So we're not talking about attachment, of course. We're talking about developing this aspiration. In fact, it's often said that this spirit of enlightenment or bodhicitta is two aspirations. There's the aspiration for enlightenment and the aspiration to benefit all sentient beings. These are together in here. And then it says, following that, it says, as long as you have not taken the bodhisattva vows, so these are vows or precepts that is going to support our practice of the six perfections, which we're going to look at tomorrow. It says, as long as you've not taken that, it is the aspirational spirit that is present.
whether or not you are training in the deeds of generosity, etc. The engaged spirit is present only once you have taken the vows and engaged in accumulating the collections of merit and wisdom. So therefore, we often talk about two types of bodhicitta. There's what's called aspiring and engaging. So aspiring bodhicitta is simply developing this wish, this aspiration for enlightenment for the benefit of others. Whereas engaging bodhicitta is actually taking steps towards enlightenment. So often the analogy given here, the difference is that if we want to go to some place, first we have to have the wish to go, and then we actually go to get to the goal. So this is the difference here. So aspiring bodhicitta is when we first develop this aspiration for enlightenment so that we can help liberate others. So we're cultivating that wish through these processes here. And then once we can strengthen this aspiration, then we can actually engage in the practices to achieve enlightenment, which are the six perfections. And so then when we start to engage in those practices, then that bodhicitta that we have is called engaging bodhicitta.
It seems like it's a little different from refuge. Back on refuge, you're like, well, you know, you can have a formal ceremony or not, you know, but if you do it, you do it.
And so, but here also the same.
Oh, is this the same?
Okay. Yeah. So here, what's recommended is that we first look at these processes, and we look at things like the benefits of bodhicitta and so forth, and then we try and cultivate this. Then we can do a formal ceremony where we make a commitment, I wish to develop this. And then on top of that, then often within the same ceremony or as an additional one, then we would do the bodhisattva vow ceremony. So like with the refuge ceremony, we make that formal commitment to take refuge, Buddha Dhamma Sangha. But also often with that comes this extra second part of then optionally taking these precepts to support our ethical life, you know, the no killing, stealing and so forth. Similarly here, once we can do this bodhicitta ceremony at both levels, and particularly the second one, we would then accept what's called the bodhisattva vows, which are precepts to help us in our practice. And there they talk about 18 root ones and 46 secondary ones. And if you look at all of those, they're all about how to help us to sustain the bodhicitta motivation and how to help us to sustain the six perfections practices, if you look at the list of all of them.
Back to wholehearted resolve and altruistic intention.
Sure.
And then how it kind of sounds like one of the best ways to personally help people is to work on the path of enlightenment. Does this kind of explain why around the world you see more Christian-based hospitals and missions versus Buddhist ones?
Well, of course, there are differences in the philosophies behind the two. But, I mean, from a Buddhist perspective, this does not mean, oh, go away, you sentient beings. I have to achieve enlightenment first. Then I'm going to come and help you. You know, don't bug me now. That's not what it means. Because we're not going to get anywhere near enlightenment that way. We need the balance. Of course, we need to try and help others as much as we can now, but to understand that we're quite limited in how we can help them. But we still try and help them in whatever way we can. In terms of material, in terms of advice and guidance, if we can do that in a good way, you know, many different ways we can help sentient beings. So, but we need to understand that if we put all our effort now just externally helping others, we're not going to leave any time or opportunity to develop ourselves. So
we're always going to be very quite limited in what we can do to help. Whereas if we sometimes then have more time for ourselves to develop ourselves, then we can more and more, as we develop in spiritual path, we can be more and more effective in helping others. And of course, we can be most effective at the highest level when we achieve enlightenment. But we shouldn't think that this means that we run off into a cave until we're enlightened and then we come out to try and help people. That's not going to work. It's not going to work. Because one of the things in the spiritual path is we need a lot of what's called merit. You know, I think I mentioned it already briefly. And a lot of merit, which is like positive energy in the path to support us in our practice, a lot of that comes from virtuous activities, helping others. And, you know, often we see, particularly in the Tibetan tradition, you know, someone who's working hard on this, particularly in the meditation practice doing retreat, and then somehow it falls apart or it doesn't go very well. Often you'll hear people say, oh, they didn't have enough merit. They didn't have enough merit. And that's true, that to sustain us in that practice, we need the merit, we need the positive energy which comes from helping others. So we need to have that balance. But again, you know, if we're spending all of our time helping others and not developing ourselves, then we're not going to get, we're going to be limited in our effectiveness. And unfortunately, we see this a little bit in like social workers, aid workers, you know, full of compassion, want to heal the world, fix the world. They go out full of enthusiasm, full of energy. 6 months later, compassion burnout. Because they forgot the wisdom. The wisdom is, if I really want to help those people, I need to look after myself. If I overextend myself, run myself down physically and mentally, I'm no use to anyone. So if you really have the compassionate attitude to help others, part of that has to be wisdom that says, okay, I need to rest now. I need to look after myself so that tomorrow I can really keep working to help others. This is smart, smart compassion. And so this is the same here.
Thank you. I was just going to say, I think there's, coming somewhat from that world, I think there's also a phenomenon where the motivation to go out and help and help and help and help and do is also a distraction, an avoidance of dealing with oneself.
Sometimes as well, yes. It can be. That can also be part of it, is that by, and then, yeah, and a lot to be said in that area, but that's certainly true.
Yeah. And you, inspiring other people to help other people, does that gain merit for you, or?
Yeah, so one thing that I'll mention this and then we'll need to stop. This is one thing I often mention at the end of these sorts of courses is, you know, often people, once they sort of get interested in some sort of spiritual path, then they go, should I do the spiritual thing or the career thing, you know? I think this is wrong thinking. Because often what people do is they abandon that and then they say, okay, I'm going to do the spiritual thing now. Okay, let's go and meditate, you know, and they go off somewhere and 2 weeks later they go, okay, what am I doing now, you know? And so basically, there's no avenue for them to express that, what they're practicing. So if we give up our career, particularly if we have talent in it and we're good at doing helping in our own way, and we give that up, well, then how are we going to implement these ideas? You know. So rather, what we need to do is integrate the two. Of course, if we're in a career that we only went into because that's not our heart's desire, we just went into it when we're young because we thought we could make a lot of money and we actually hate it, then maybe we can think about doing something more what we want to do. But if we're in a career that we really like and can really have some talent in, then use spiritual path to be able to help people more effectively. Because otherwise, you know, what are we going to do if we give up that, our talent? We can't. We've got to have some avenue to benefit others. So I think this is an important point. Yeah. Okay, let's stop there because we've run out of time. A few small points maybe I'll cover again tomorrow on this, and then I'm going to move on to the second approach, the exchanging self with others, which we see beginning on the bottom of page 21.
And then we're going to go through, later we see that how to train in the Mahayana in general, which talks about then the six perfections. So there's a big, big, extensive presentation of these six perfections practices. And I'm not sure how far we'll get tomorrow, but probably, in fact, I think we'll get through all of it because we're going to summarize a lot of it. So we're probably going to get down to bottom of page 32. So a little bit of light bedtime reading for you this evening. But again, we're not going to go through all of it in huge detail, but if you want to look at some of the main points, that might be useful. And then this afternoon, this evening, you'll be meditating on some of the points that we've been looking at here, a little bit, some of the stages of the seven cause and effect, some of the four immeasurables, some of the four immeasurables as well, kindness of others and so forth. So that's the topic for this afternoon, this evening. So let's have a break. Come back, and then I'll see you tomorrow morning.